But we get it underway by welcoming back to the program a talented guy who used to write about baseball. These days, he is a music journalist for the American Songwriter, host of the podcast You, Me, and an album. We're happy to welcome back our friend Al Melchior. Al, how are you?
I'm doing great and doing a little bit better after that introduction. So thank you, Rich. I appreciate it.
Well, I'm just sad in many ways, happy that you've got this gig at American Songwriter because you write so well about music. But we used to have you come on around this time every year to talk fantasy baseball. I don't know who to turn to convince me now that my faith in Andrew Vaughn is justified.
Well, I sort of know. I would think I was notoriously wrote a piece a little more than a year ago about how Andrew Vaughn was not going to make it the year as the White Sox starting first baseman. So that turned out to be terribly wrong, as lots of people let me know ahead of time that it would be. And so anyway, I'm not the guy for that job. Anyway.
Well, tell us about this transition into writing about music, which certainly you were already doing a lot of that with the wonderful podcast.
I appreciate it, Rich. Yeah, and the podcast certainly was the start of things. And in a way, the baseball stuff was too, because I had interviewed Scott McCoy, who had been a touring and recording member of REM for several years.
A friend of our show.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go. So, awesome guy to interview, awesome guy, period. And so I interviewed him on baseball podcasts a few times. And then I started the You Mean an Album podcast in 2020. And he was one of the first guests that I had because I, certainly was looking for a range of people to interview about music, including musicians. And it's like, well, I've got some familiarity with Scott, and he does with me, and he was gracious enough to be one of the first guests, as were you. So the baseball, there were some baseball music connections there, but yeah, then I started the podcast in 2020 and did a little bit of freelance writing for Bandcamp Daily, and now I'm doing a regular freelance thing for American Songwriter and have been now for about 6-7 months. So it's been awesome.
And the podcast is going great. You have moved on from schlubs like me. You got people like Steve Hackett, Juliana Hatfield, Danny O'Keefe, our friend Dan Epstein. You get such great guests, and it's always a fascinating conversation.
Well, and I had great guests in the early going, too, like you and Scott and many others. It's fantastic. And to be able to, interview people like Steve Hackett and Juliana Hatfield, who I've been a fan of for a long time, it's crazy, and it's wonderful. So I'm just glad that I get to do that.
Well, one of the regular features you do at the American Songwriter is Artist Remorse. What was the inspiration behind that?
I was trying to remember that because I know you and I had a little bit of an exchange about this series before. And I was like, where did I come up with the idea for this? And just to be clear, I think I originated the idea, but there have been a number of writers at American Songwriter who have also written on the theme, too. But it was probably one of the early albums that I wrote about, maybe David Bowie, Never Let Me Down, or I'm trying to think what some of the other early ones that I wrote about, Bruce Springsteen's Human Touch. And I think, just thought, well, this is kind of an interesting angle. Like, I always wonder, and just to give another example from the series, Around the Sun by REM, and one of the things that I wrote in that piece was, they were so incredibly consistent and never had an album that was, critically dismissed, much less one that, didn't do well commercially after their, their first couple. And even those did pretty well. It was just kind of a shock. And it's like, well, how do these albums that people don't generally like as much, how does this happen? What goes wrong? So I think that was pretty much just the curiosity that led me to write a bunch of pieces on this.
Well, Human Touch, I'm glad you mentioned that because that remains one of my favorite Springsteen albums. Why didn't it resonate like others?
Well, yeah, that's an interesting story. And these are all, have all turned out to be interesting stories. And there are themes that carry over from one album to the other. So in the case of Human Touch, there were a couple of things with that one. And I just want to add the caveat, too, that of all, I think I've written a dozen of these, and of that dozen, this is the one that was probably the most borderline in terms of the artist having remorse about it. I mean, Springsteen was quoted as saying, Yeah, it didn't do very well commercially, but he wasn't damning of it the way that, say, Phil Collins has been damning of No Jacket Required or REM about Around the Sun. But with the Bruce Springsteen one, with Human Touch, he had moved to California from New Jersey. He had ditched the E Street Band. So I think a part of the fan base was reacting against that, and maybe a part of the music journalism circle as well. But he also admitted that, you know, some things he knew didn't resonate as well. And he'd been quoted about the 59 Channels video as being, you know, not his best work. And he was shooting for irony, and that's not something he's good at. So I think it was a bit of trying to adjust to changing expectations of his fan base and maybe just missing the mark on it. Because it was a weird time when that album came out. He hadn't put one out, I think, in 5 years. And then he put two albums out at the same time, that and Lucky Town. And grunge was happening. And you know, what made him popular in the mid-'80s had kind of passed the listening public by. So I think it was one of these adjustment transitional type albums.
We're talking with Al Melchior, the American songwriter, here on Downtown. I really enjoyed the artist remorse piece on Elvis Costello's Goodbye Cruel World. And as you point out, well, Elvis's thoughts on the album were right there in the liner notes.
Yeah, that was maybe one of the easiest ones to write, because he's been very public and prolific about, you know, what is wrong with that album. And again, that's the kind of thing that to me really makes it interesting to research and write these pieces, because when the artist themselves is not big on the album, it's like, well, you put all this time and effort into it, why don't you like it? And in his case, it was really a clash between what he wanted the album to be and the producers that he was working with. And they were the same producers he worked with to make Punch the Clock, which was one of his more popular albums and very well received by critics. And the producers kind of wanted to do Punch the Clock Part 2. And he said, no, I want to do something that's moodier and more downbeat. And they compromised. And for the most part, I think Costello actually got what he wanted from that. But he had to concede and make some poppier tunes on the album, including Every Day I Write the Book, which he apparently doesn't think very much of. And it was kind of a challenge to himself to see how quickly he could write a throwaway pop song. And he did it, and he did it very well, but I don't think he really loved the end result.
It's interesting in these artist remorse pieces, it seems to sort of bounce back and forth between producers who maybe had too much control, or artists who had reached a level of creative control where they could do whatever they wanted, and that didn't always work, not having some accountability.
Yeah, no, that's it. I mean, so many of these, the issue was between the match or lack thereof between the artist and producer. The Replacements, Don't Tell a Soul. Actually, they were fine with the producer, but they didn't care for the way that it was mixed. And so they actually just very recently, I think in the past year, did a remixed version of it, which I have to admit sounds a ton better. On the other hand, you talk about the musicians needing a steadier hand in production. I think Yes's Union album was one where the producer had a certain idea for the album, and sort of like the Elvis Costello one where he wanted to be poppier and more similar to the 80s Yes albums like 90125. And John Anderson and some of the other members of the band wanted something that was more like 70s Yes. And it just, the whole thing just went amok. In fact, if you look at the patterns of what went wrong with each of these albums, Yes Union is kind of like the mother of all incredible albums. Like everything that could go wrong went wrong. The band didn't get along with each other. They didn't get along with the producer. They were under time pressures. They weren't clear on really what they were trying to do with the album. It was like everything that could have gone wrong went wrong.
And one album that you wrote about, Supertramp's Famous Last Words, that was essentially about the different perspective of the leads in the band, Roger Hodgson and Rick Davies, who always wanted to take things in different directions.
Yeah. So that was an interesting one too, right? And after Breakfast in America, it just seemed like Supertramp could do no wrong. And so when they came out with this album, it was kind of a head scratcher. Like what happened here? And basically Roger Hodgson didn't really want to be in the band anymore. Like you said, Rich, he kind of wanted to do his own thing and do things that were more pop oriented. And Rick Davies wanted to do really the type of thing that he wound up doing on the next Supertramp album after Roger Hodgson left, with longer, more extended pieces and definitely much less of a pop sensibility. And so it was another situation, kind of like the Elvis Costello album, where they tried to compromise, but what they wound up doing wasn't what either of them wanted from the album. So nobody was happy with Famous Last Word.
I love a recent piece you had about an album that was a critical success, one of my favorite albums of the late 70s and early 80s, when you wrote about the making of Squeeze's East Side Story.
Yeah, that was cool. That was a cool thing to write about. And I was not aware of it at the time. And, you know, I really loved that album, but apparently didn't read the liner notes. I mean, Elvis Costello produced most of it, but I wasn't aware of the larger backstory of Paul McCartney in the very early phases, wanting to be involved and asked to be involved in the production, Nick Lowe, Dave Edmonds. So, yeah, I mean, could you imagine if Squeeze was able to pull off a four-sided album with each one of those legends producing a side? I mean, it all, sometimes when you get so many big names involved, it winds up being disappointing. That maybe could have been a very disjointed-sounding album, but just the fact that they tried to do that, and they tried to do that with not really having that big of a following in the U.S. at the time either, is pretty incredible.
Loved your piece on the making of Al Stewart's classic Year of the Cat. We had Al on the show a few years ago, and much like in his music, in interviews, he is just a phenomenal storyteller.
He really is. So that was another fun one to research and to look at video clips of him explaining the song. Yeah, great storyteller in interviews, great storyteller with his music. And he was the subject of a fairly early You, Me, and an Album episode where we talked about Modern Times, and that exposed me to an album of Al Stewart that's not quite as well known as Year of the Cat or Time Passages. But yeah, no, really interesting story of him just trying and trying again to find the right lyric to go with this beautiful piano melody, which, you know, so many people know, and I think is probably the reason for why so many people love that song. It's just a gorgeous melody, but he went through several different iterations of lyrics trying to find the right match and trying to find one that he could live with and that the record company could live with. And obviously, he, after a long time, he finally found that.
Yeah, and he hated the saxophone and didn't want that having anything to do with folk rock.
Right. Yeah, but like you said, sometimes the producer knows best. So, and it's a great story, too. I don't recall where I read or saw this, but that the saxophone player was basically interrupted from watching a movie, came in, played the part, went back to watching the movie. So minimal involvement, but got the job done, obviously.
Well, Al, you were doing such great work at the American Songwriter. You are productive, sir. You're cranking them out about every couple of days here.
Yeah, I recently took just a little bit of time off, so you know, I think soon it'll be back to pretty much every day something new on there. Well, which is great. It's great to have the work. It's great to be able to write about things that I love to write about and to learn more about. And I appreciate Rich. Appreciate you checking it all out.
Well, it's always a well-researched and insightful, and so love it as much as I did your baseball writing, maybe even more. Al, it is great to talk with you again. Continue the good works, and we'll have you back on down the road.
Oh, always a pleasure, Rich. Thank you so much.
That's Al Melchior from the American Songwriter with us here on Downtown.